The following is an exclusive sports presentation of Extra Sports 1300.
Next, I'd like to introduce...
Throw your hands in the air if you's a true player.
Southern Colorado, it's time for your live and local sports talk show.
That boy is good.
Good and terrible.
Drive Time Sports, presented by Tilted Kilt Pub and Eatery, your sports action hub with over 54 TVs so you don't miss out on the action, located at Woodman and I-25. The only place to hear talk about your teams.
I think you two dudes are going to become real homies.
Where do we find these guys?
Oh, man, I hate those guys.
Here are your hosts, Ryan Kaufman and Chris Braden, with the godfather of Colorado Springs Sports Radio, Wheels.
Good Wednesday to you. Welcome to the show. Ryan and Wheels with you in studio. Chris on assignment. Lot to get to today. Guest-wise, we will be joined by Tim Fisher, host of Fish on Football, Saturdays, 7 a.m., right here on Extra Sports 1300. He will join us to talk about the breaking news of the afternoon that Bob Stoops stepping down after 18 seasons at Oklahoma. And I literally, like a lot of people are saying, I can't remember. It's hard to remember Oklahoma without Bob. I don't remember. Like, period. Like, I know Switzer coached there, but I seriously don't remember watching or, you know, thinking about anything Oklahoma football without Bob Stoops. So very interesting stuff, and we'll talk with Tim coming up in just a few minutes. Hour number two, the Major League Baseball draft is less than a week away. Jim Callis from MLB.com will join us to give you a primer. Who are the players you should be looking out for? A lot of interesting questions. It could potentially be the first high school player drafted number one overall this year. So very interesting stuff. Jim Callis will join us in hour number two. And then hour number three, Grant Meech will join us on the program. So three great guests. I want to start today, though, with something that has been troubling me. Yesterday we had the discussion about the Bulls of 96, the Warriors of 2017, who would win and why. And then after we have that discussion, we see Magic Johnson's comments saying that the Lakers that he played on with Kareem and Worthy would sweep this year's version of the Warriors. And then today you have Dr. J, who, by the way, is one of my favorite players of all time. I love Dr. J. He says his team would beat the Golden State Warriors. So now this is like a thing going on now. Who from the past could beat the Warriors of the present? And it's getting to be a little bit silly, to be quite honest with you. I enjoy the debate, but it's, I mean, come on. All these players are coming out of the woodwork saying their teams would be, and then Robert Horry said that Hakeem Olajuwon was 20 times better than Tim Duncan. So it's the Michael Jordan, LeBron debate. It's the Warriors, Bulls debate. It's Olajuwon and Duncan for no apparent reason. So this is becoming a thing, and I just think that the hypothetical historical debate we should be having about basketball has nothing to do with the Sixers of Dr. J. It has nothing to do with the Showtime Lakers. Why don't we actually discuss teams that have beaten the Bulls and beaten the Warriors? Who might that be? Let me flash you back. February 4th, 1996.
Michael down low with Mahmoud. Inside to Jordan. Rejected by Mutombo. To Stiff. And this one is over. The Denver Nuggets have ended the Chicago Bulls club record 18-game winning streak and have come away with a 105-99 victory over the Chicago Bulls.
That's right. When the Bulls lost only 10 games, guess who one of those 10 was? the Denver Nuggets. At the time, the Bulls, when they lost to the Nuggets, fell to 41-4 at that point. 105-99 was the final score. Michael Jordan scored 39, but it didn't turn out to be as important as Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf's 32 points. And the Nuggets come away with a win over the Bulls. So the Denver Nuggets of 1996 don't have to throw out hypotheticals about the 96 Bulls. They beat them head-to-head, everybody healthy, mano-a-mano, not the third game of a back-to-back-to-back. The Nuggets beat the Bulls. So the Nuggets can say that. You know what else the Nuggets can say? Let's earlier this year, like March-ish.
Jokic brings the basketball up. Jokic has it between the circles. Dribbling a handoff to Jamal Murray. Murray stops and shoots a three. Franchise record! 23-pointers in the basketball game, and the Denver Nuggets have set a new mark.
And down to 4 seconds with 3 seconds with two. He's going to dribble it out. The Denver Nuggets have tied the NBA record for made threes in the game with 24. And the Denver Nuggets come away with a win, 132-110.
A combination of Jason Kosminski and also Warriors Radio on the call there. Yes, remember that game? The Nuggets set a then NBA record for most made three-pointers in the game. I think the Cavs broke it like 2 weeks later. But it was enough to carry them to a victory over the 2017 Golden State Warriors. So now you have the hypothetical historical debate that we should be having. The 1996 Denver Nuggets, led by Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, Antonio McDyess, and Dikembe Mutombo, and LaPhonso Ellis, going up against the 2017 Denver Nuggets of Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray, Wilson Chandler, etc., etc. That is the debate that we should be having, and I am totally serious, guys. Okay, maybe not totally serious. But, look, the Nuggets have beaten two of the best teams in the history of the National Basketball Association. And I don't know. Dr. J played in the ABA. I guess that was with the Nets, so it wouldn't be his comments were about the Sixers. But maybe the Nuggets beat Dr. J's Sixers. Maybe they beat the Showtime Lakers. I'm just saying, why are we having all these historical, hypothetical debates when you have two teams that have beaten both of the teams in question and are the same franchise? That's the debate we should be having. So that is the poll question I am putting out to you today at Extra Sports 1300, Twitter, Facebook. Who would win, the 1996 Nuggets or the 2017 Nuggets? I eagerly await your thoughts. You can also expand on them, 286-0046. I'll give you my take coming up a little bit later on in the show. The MLB draft begins in 5 days, and joining us now to tell you the players you'll be wanting to keep an eye out for, he's a senior writer for MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com. Jim Callis is my guest. As you look at this draft class as a whole, how would you compare it in terms of top-end talent and in depth to previous years?
You know, I was going to say, every year I have to tell myself, you know, when I talk to scouts and draft evaluators, they always seem, you know, with the exception this decade of 2011, they seem a little disappointed in the crop as a whole. I think basically because the pro teams do such a great job of taking guys and signing them out of high school that the college crops are a little thinned out. I think it's just kind of par for the course this decade. I mean, the college position player crop is not very good, but that's kind of typical. College pitchers backed up a little bit. Got not so much injuries, but guys just regressing for the most part. Most of the top, I thought coming into the year we maybe could have had six or seven pitchers taking the top 12 college guys, and that's not going to happen now. But that said, you know, if you look from their side, I think there's five pretty good players at the top of the draft in whatever order you like them. You know, I would probably. And I kind of change my order every day, Ryan. But if I was lining up the top five guys, and I think they're all pretty close, I would probably go North Carolina high school lefty Mackenzie Gore, one. Vanderbilt righty Kyle Wright, two. Sports Illustrated cover boy in Southern California right-hander Hunter Green, three, high school kid. Louisville two-way star Brendan McKay, four. And California, not sure if he's going to be a shortstop or an outfielder, but he's a pretty good athlete and hitter. Royce Lewis would be number five for me.
So what you're saying is that the Twins do have a very difficult decision, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's obvious, although you could flip that around and say that, do you wish there was, like, Bryce Harper, you know, standing atop this draft? Yes, but the nice thing is if you have five guys and you think the five guys are pretty close, then it gives you a little leverage to maybe cut a deal with one of them and save some money to spend on extra picks, too. So, like, I think you could defend any of those five players. I think Mackenzie Gore's the best guy. I think Kyle Wright's got the best combination of floor and ceiling of any of those guys. I think Hunter Green might have the highest ceiling. Brendan McKay probably has the highest floor, and you could take him as a pitcher or a first baseman. And in this draft, if you're talking about position players combining athleticism and hitability, then Royce Lewis is the best of those. So, it's not that there isn't a worthy candidate. There's just more of them. I think they're all bunched up pretty close together.
What would you take Brendan McKay as?
I would take him as a hitter. What's funny is, and I had a little note on MLBPipeline.com today, I do think the first three teams to pick, the Twins, the Reds, and Padres, I think the Reds would definitely take him as a pitcher. I think the Twins and Padres are leaning towards taking him as a pitcher. You know, if you've seen him at the end of the season, if you saw him in the regional last week on ESPN, he was sitting around 90 miles an hour with his fastball. Now, granted, he is tired. He is pulling double duty. You know, but even when he's, like, you know, at his best, he kind of sits around 92, 93. It's not an overwhelming fastball. It's a plus curveball. It's good control. He throws a changeup. He really competes. But, like, I see him. The teams will really like him on the mound. They see him as a number two starter. To me, he's more of a number three. And as a hitter, I mean, I think he might be the best combination of bat and power in the draft. I mean, you could have a 300 hitting, you know, 20 homer guy. So I would take him as a position player.
Jim Callis, senior writer at MLB.com and MLBPipeline.com, joining us here on Drive Time Sports. You mentioned maybe drafting one guy in order to save money for other picks. Now, what are we, fifth year with this new kind of system in place? As you look back, is the process ultimately better?
You know, I will grudgingly say it probably is. Like I would rather see it. I think the draft's the best and cheapest way to build your team, and you look at what teams like the Pirates and Royals did by investing heavily in the draft, which you can't do the same way. The Rays did as well, and you can't do it quite the same way now because especially if you're a team and you win, you're limited what you could spend. So in a perfect world, if I'm named commissioner and I can just have far-reaching powers, I'm letting teams spend whatever they want on the draft. But before we had the bonus pool system, there were no rules, but MLB would exert pressure on teams to try to get them not to spend on the draft. But that said, while we don't have that, what was bad about the old system was you had MLB exerting pressure on these teams not to spend on the draft, and you had a handful of teams that spent aggressively and several teams that kind of towed the line and did what MLB wanted them to do, and it was kind of unfair because, you know, let's say I was one of the teams that had, you know, my ownership said, we're towing the line, we're doing what MLB wants. Well, it takes a bunch of players out of the mix for me. And conversely, if I'm a team that's willing to spend money, all I have to do is say, like just to give you an example, and there's nothing wrong with it, they didn't break any rules, but like the Royals got Will Myers in the third round for $2 million. Well, the reason Will Myers was in the third round of the draft, because some teams consider him a first-round pick, was he wanted $2 million, and he just wasn't in a spot where teams felt like they could give it to him without MLB, you know, getting ballistic about it behind the scenes. So it was very easy. If you were willing to spend money, all you had to do was promise a player, you know, a sum of money that would make him fall, and lo and behold, that guy would fall to you. And you know, unless one of the other teams that was willing to spend big money snapped him up, but it was a, you know, 6-8 teams that were willing to do that, and they could kind of, you know, steer players to themselves in later rounds. And you know, while again, I like teams being able to spend what they want, that wasn't really a fair system because some teams were using artificial limits and other teams weren't.
Jim Callis, MLB.com, MLBPipeline.com, joining us on the show. You mentioned Hunter Green earlier in the mix there among the top picks in this draft. Do you think that he profiles better as a position player or as a pitcher?
As a pitcher. I mean, he has a chance to go number one, and he'll go in the. You know, I don't think he'll go lower than two, and certainly not three as a pitcher. As a position player, you know, look, he's got arm strength, he's got power. He might be more of a third baseman than a shortstop, but he profiles there. He'd be more, I think, in that 15 to 25 range in the first round. So it's just different. Now, you could argue, and it's funny because we taped a draft top 100 prospects show at MLB Network. That it's aired for the first time over the weekend, and I think they're still showing it this week, where Harold Reynolds would take him as a position player. But as a pitcher, you know, on one hand, you know, he's very athletic, it's a super quick arm, he can hit 102 miles an hour, hasn't shown a great feel for spinning the ball. I think it's going to wind up being a slider more than the curve. He's never really pitched a whole lot. I mean, I don't know if counting summers in high school, that he's even pitched 150 innings 4 years of high school. So while it's a great arm, hasn't really been taxed at all, and I do worry a little bit about guys who throw that hard holding up, no matter how good or their mechanics are or how athletic they are. It just doesn't seem like a lot of guys last that long throwing that hard. So, I still think the ceiling's a lot higher on the mound, but you could make, you know, Harold Reynolds will definitely take him as a position player, and I think you could make an argument for it, but I think 30 teams out of 30 or 29 out of them, I mean, there may be a lone team out there would take him as a pitcher over a hitter. McKay, I really think it's closer to 50-50.
Understanding that, yes, there is some strategy involved when it comes to the bonus pool that you have, but who's somebody that you've kind of seen isn't really getting a lot of love, but you like a lot? Who might be a steal in the latter part of the first round?
You know, I think the best way to answer that question is, it's weird because it's like, well, not weird, but, you know, as we're getting this close to draft, we've talked to, you know, so many people about this stuff, and I feel like our list is in pretty good shape. So I feel like we've got our guys lined up. So there aren't too many guys I think are going to go a lot lower than they deserve. But I do think one steal towards the top of the draft, who should, for me, would be about the number six pick, but he'll probably go on the team somewhere, is Jaron Kendall from Vanderbilt. Yes, his strikeout rate is higher than teams would like. He still has the best all-around tools, and he's very productive. In the college ranks, he's got the best all-around tools in the college ranks. And let's say he doesn't hit for high average, I still think he's a 15 homer, 30 to 40 steal, you know, really good defender in center field. So Jaron Kendall could go, you know, 10 spots lower than he should. And the one demographic that always goes lower than they should, because people are worried about him getting hurt, are high school pitchers. I think there's a high school pitcher from Minnesota named Sam Carlson who belongs in the middle of the first round. He'll probably go towards the bottom of the first round. There's guys like Blaine Enloe from Louisiana. You know, Matt Sauer from California belong at the end of the first round. They might go more in the second round. I think all in all, you probably can get the best values if you're willing to take high school pitchers, especially high school righties.
It's time for Crunch Time.
It's time!
Hey, you hear that?
Do you hear that?
What is that?
What is that?
Yeah, what is that?
What is it?
It's crunch time. It's crunch time. Yay! It's crunch time.
National days, it is National Boone Day, not Boone Logan.
Not T. Boone Pickens either.
Not T. Boone Pickens, Daniel Boone. It's observed each year on this date to commemorate the day frontiersman Daniel Boone first began exploring the valleys and forests of the present-day bluegrass state of Kentucky in 1769. So there's that. It's also National Running Day. So
F that.
Going back to what I was saying about the hefty boys. And finally, it's National Chocolate Ice Cream Day.
Okay.
Love chocolate ice cream. Are you a fan of chocolate ice cream?
I like chocolate ice cream. Okay. Not my favorite kind, but good.
What is, so the question, it's not going to be what is your favorite ice cream, because come on, that's every ice cream day we ask that question. What is your favorite way to eat ice cream?
Favorite way to eat ice cream? Yes. Always. Not even like sometimes I may, always in a bowl.
Always.
In always.
A bowl. Okay.
Always in a bowl.
That's it. Just
no, no cone. Wow. If I had to, I mean, it's semantics, but my favorite way is still, and kudos to whoever at Security Service Field does this, ice cream in a mini helmet is the tops.
That was going to be my next question. Do you go cup, the little cup, or do you go the little extra for the mini helmet?
Always the mini helmet. Okay. Yes, I always spring for the mini helmet.
Does it matter the team, or do you just get whatever one they have?
No, I don't care. Okay. I really don't. I think last time we were there, I ended up with the Brewers one.
Okay. Did you save them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, one of my kids went with the Rays, and I think we had one more that.
Do you have a full collection yet?
No.
Okay.
No. I would have kept mine from when I went to the Rockies games growing up and doing that, maybe. But no, not even close. So I would say the helmet is the pinnacle of ice cream eating.
But you never go cone.
Never go cone. Must be a container.
No sandwiches.
Not really.
No.
Okay. No.
All right. I like the ice cream sandwich. I love ice cream sandwiches.
Ice cream sandwich, okay.
Doesn't, you know, cookie, I like the chocolate chip cookie thing, just the regular ice cream sandwich. That's my all-time favorite. I love ice cream sandwiches. Give me an ice cream sandwich and I'm a happy boy.
Heck yes. By the way, congratulations to Alan. He won the $25 gift certificate to Ranch Foods Direct.
Yum.
Okay, so Jerry Remy, who is the Red Sox broadcaster. Yeah.
Where's Dan Acheson?
Right, no kidding. So last night, apparently, there was a meeting on the mound between Masahiro Tanaka, Jerry Rothschild, the pitching coach for the Yankees, and Tanaka's interpreter.
Yes.
And Remy said, I don't think that should be legal. I really don't. Learn baseball language. It's pretty simple. You break it down pretty easy between pitching coach and pitcher after a long period of time. He's gotten in trouble for this, as you can imagine. Well,
yeah. This isn't like the first time he's done something dumb.
Okay, so let me go ahead and just ask the question then, and then you can continue your thought. Is this PC police running out of control, or do you think that those comments were not appropriate?
No, those were totally out of line. I mean, that's a dumb thing to say. I mean, if I were the guy, I don't know who his broadcast partner is.
Dave O'Brien.
If I were Dave O'Brien, I'd turn to him and say, why don't you go learn Japanese and see how easy it is? Learning a second language, once you, I don't know what age it is, but there's a certain age. Once you hit a certain age, learning a second language or whatever, it's not.
Or an instrument. I think it's like 30. Once you're past
it's
that.
It's not easy.
It's a wrap. Yeah.
So, you know, coming from Japan over to the United States and having to learn English just to play baseball. No, come on, man. Like, yeah, eventually he should be able to pick it up. And have a basic conversation with the pitching coach, but you're still going to need an interpreter. You know, he's not going to fully grasp the English language. It was an idiotic thing for him to say.
Right. And I know that there are people that get upset with Ichiro because they think he hides behind an interpreter sometimes and won't,
It's not hiding. Like, even if a person can speak the language,
mm-hmm.
they may not fully understand it.
Right, and then O'Brien, to his credit, said, I would probably say that they're concerned about nuance being lost in some of the conversations. So it's not that they can't understand. People that have been here for a long time can't understand and be able to say things, but you're trying to,
right?
You know, if you're trying to infer something or you're trying to, mm-hmm. it, it's very difficult, yeah. And it sounds very xenophobic and ignorant.
Yes.
And I'm not calling for this guy's head.
No.
I just think it was a really stupid thing to say. Now, if he's like, you know, if he can't speak our language, he should go back to Japan. Then, okay, now right. You're fired. But I just think he was dumb, and he should realize that the English is the most difficult, and they're coming over here to work.
Exactly. And
I don't know Tanaka's living situation. A lot of the guys go back
yes.
after the season. I mean, they're working here. They're not a full-time, full-blooded, you know what I mean, full-time citizens. But be that as it may, ridiculous comment, but yeah. I'm not saying that Jerry Remy should lose his job.
Well, and obviously, like, you know, a lot of people don't think of the translator aspect of the game because in a lot of situations, a team will have multiple players that speak the same language,
mm-hmm.
especially when it comes to the Hispanic players.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have the two players, you know, or something.
And by the way, what is the big deal?
Yeah.
Like, let's get back to the root of this. What does it matter if there is two guys out at the
or something? I don't know.
Oh, God. I'm so sick of the – Rob Manfred was en route earlier today for the Rockies game and hit the nail on the – it's not the length of the game. It's the pace. And as long as the interpreter and Rothschild – trot out at a similar pace.
Yeah.
What is the freaking difference?
It's not like Rothschild walks up there and goes, oh crap, I need the translator. Come on.
And it's not like in other times when you have a meeting that the entire infield doesn't come in.
Right.
It's so stupid at its ridiculous. Core, and then it gets more and more xenophobic and ridiculous as you start to peel it apart.
As you're driving home, here are the three stories that are driving Drive Time Sports.
What's driving the show? Brought to you by Bob Pincus, celebrating their 60th anniversary. Head on down and see them in Motor City, and then you'll find out why nobody buys just one. Story number one.
That's why we love the game. This ball is hit toward right center field with authority. It's going to get down and... two runs have scored. DJ to third. He's going to get a late stop sign. Nolan comes through. 2-0 Colorado. How good that must feel for Arenado, especially after last night.
Root Sports on the call. Rockies complete the two-game sweep of the defending American League champions. 8-1 the final score. Nolan Arenado. 3-for-5 with a double and a triple. Kyle Freeland, 6 1/3, 1 run on 6 hits, no walks, 5 strikeouts, gets the W. First game, by the way, for Kyle Freeland in which he did not walk a batter. And now, piggybacking on Antonio Senzatella's strong start last night, in which Senzatella drove in as many runs as he gave up, 3, in a win for the Rockies last night. The Rockies rookie pitching duo is now 15-5 combined. Their ERA coming into today, but it should go down after the performance by Freeland, 3.55. Last night, I did some research and I looked at rookie duos when it came to pitching in the major leagues since the turn of the century. I just like saying that because it makes you feel like I did like...
over 100 years of research.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it was 17, but it took me a while. What they're doing is not as rare as you might think. It just actually just happened last year with the Brewers. Junior Guerra and Zach Davies were 20-10. I can go back 2012, Jared Parker and Tommy Malone for the A's, 26-18. Jeff Niemann and David Price for the Rays were 23-13. So there's about 10 seasons since 2000 where you had a rookie duo in the same realm as Senzatella and Freeland. Here's the part that is different and interesting. and awesome if you're a Rockies fan. None of these teams, save for one, 2012, Jared Parker, Tommy Malone for the A's. The A's that year finished 94-68, won their division. Other than that, there has not been a rookie pitching duo that has led their team to the playoffs, which Antonio Senzatella and Kyle Freeland are on pace to do.
So you're saying it's not good for the Rockies to have this going on?
I don't know. And we have a texter that might agree with you. It's a rare feat for two rookies to lead a staff to the playoffs because good teams don't have room for two rookie pitchers. And it's an indictment of the Rockies' talent that they now have two rookies leading them. I would disagree on both ends, the latter much more than the former. But let me address the former. I can go through and I can show you years where the Red Sox had two rookies, Yankees had two rookies, Cubs, Cardinals, name it. That's not necessarily true. It is true, though, that bad teams normally have multiple rookies, but it's not true necessarily that good teams don't, because there have been plenty of good teams that have had multiple rookie pitchers. Now, as far as an indictment, I get what you're saying, because the Rockies for so long haven't been developing their pitchers good enough to make them starters. But I think, if anything, this year, we have seen that the Rockies have as much depth in their starting rotation as any team in Major League Baseball. You have a lot of different options. So it's an indictment of perhaps the Rockies' inability to develop in the past, but is not an indictment now, because all of their pitchers, except for Tyler Chatwood, have been rookies within the last 2 years. So they're flush with talent right now, but certainly should have had a few veterans that you groomed. So I kind of get to what you're saying, but I would overall disagree with that. Story number two.
2.5 years later, it's fair to say it isn't enough. And that's positive in that that's the way things have gone in the last 2.5 years, that really the only thing that's ever acceptable anymore is dismissal.
That's Bob Stoops. Today he retired. He has spent the last 18 years in that post. That audio you heard was when he was defending his handling of Joe Mixon. And there are questions that are going to be asked, you know, who's the long-term answer as the head coach? Can Oklahoma get back to where they were? Blah, 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 blah. Sitting here in Colorado, we're not in the Big 12 anymore. So the topic that I am interested in is, what is Bob Stoops' lasting legacy? How much has Joe Mixon, first of all, how much did Joe Mixon play into the decision? And also, how much does his handling of Joe Mixon stain the legacy of Bob Stoops, which is a legacy also, as people are pointing out, where he was 500 in bowl games. You mentioned earlier, Wheels, that Big Game Bob was trending, which is mean. The guy retired, and you're bringing up how he failed on the biggest stages of his career as much as he succeeded. So I'm interested to what the legacy of Bob Stoops will be. And I throw out the question to you, and you can answer it at 286-0046. What will you ultimately remember Bob Stoops for? Winning, losing at the biggest times, Joe Mixon. What are you going to – because I think right now it's very difficult not to think of Joe Mixon immediately. Although as time passes, I think Joe Mixon won't be as much a part of his greater legacy. But right now, it's hard to ignore it. But Bob Stoops retiring after 18 seasons at the helm in Norman.